That moment basically made me realize that hope is not an entitlement, it's not a right, but it's a duty.
Welcome to The Regeneration Will Be Funded. I'm your host, Matthew Monahan, and in this series, we're having conversations about regenerative finance, technology, and our living planet. How can we build an economy that's in service to life? Brought to you by Ma Earth. You can find all of our conversations at maearth.com. Thanks for joining us. Today's guest is Oscar Soria, campaign director at Avaaz. In this conversation, we talk about Oscar's experience in this movement, including his advocacy work to get recognition for Indigenous peoples into the Kunming Montreal Global Biodiversity Framework. Oscar provides context about the many years and struggle that went into that effort. We also talk about what Oscar is seeing in the finance landscape, including debt swaps for land tenure. And Oscar shares why he believes that hope is our duty. This was a heartwarming conversation that took place at New York Climate Week in 2023. Let's dive right in with Oscar Soria. Today we are here with Oscar Soria. Oscar is the campaign director at Avaaz. Thank you so much, Oscar.
Thank you for having me.
So Avaaz, maybe we start there. What is Avaaz?
Well, Avaaz is a movement that have 70 million members around the world. And our mission is just to close the gap between the world that we have and the world that we want. Mm. And that covers many world challenges, from human rights, the ecological crisis, the economic injustice. And our members are very ambitious because they want to just to have a better world for our kids, for the next generations, and for this generation as well. Mm-hmm. And that's basically is a model where people take action online, putting pressure to governments, companies, in order just to really fulfill their commitments in the world stage. And that's what we do every day.
Mm-hmm. And you've been doing this for some time now. Can you share a bit about your background and how you came into this work?
Well, I mean, since I was a teenager, I started a small NGO in Argentina with indigenous peoples and local communities to stop evictions. And since then life put me in Greenpeace, then in WWF, doing campaigning, activism, doing trouble here and there, giving them health to companies and governments. And that has been basically my life in the last 30 years.
Mm. And just before we started, you were mentioning, you know, the strategy of telling truth and mm-hmm. speaking truth. What does that mean to you?
Well, there has been in, you know, since, especially since the early 2000s, this idea that we need to be in the room, that we need to speak with governments, we need just to persuade them, we need just to be the whisperers, the de facto people that they can consult about environmental policies. But that model is not working. I mean, clearly it's not working because we are basically off track of many of the targets and the goals that governments themselves has put. And let's remember that governments, they put very low bars, and yet they are not even getting into those low bars. And so I just feel that this is the time just to move from this persuasive advocacy or friendly advocacy into a truth teller advocacy, mm-hmm. where you just tell it the things how it is. Just really bring back the authenticity of our demands, of our work, of what we believe the world should be, because somehow we just got framed in this survivalist idea, right? Rather mm-hmm. than just thriving. So why we need just to set into a low bar just to get by, while the world could actually have the chances just to have a better world and just not just have, for instance, at least protection of 30% by 2030, which basically already is a goal that has been achieved by indigenous peoples, and yet the indigenous peoples has been recognized in terms of their lands, or just really going to the zero emission rather than net zero. So we have technology, we have the money. The thing is, now they are in the wrong agendas. And what we need to do is we need just to really go back to the radical, because The NGOs and the nonprofit and the social movement has been accused to be radical for quite a long time. And now what we are seeing in the last 10 years is science telling us we need to have radical changes because this time of complacency that we have in the last 20 years, we lost a lot of time in really in getting to a space where we can actually change. Now we need just to move faster, and the leap is huge. And so the more time we lose, the more difficult will be just to get into that. So the fact that now science is more clear to us that that radical change needs to happen, this means that governments need just to have that. So when they tell us, well, you're being too radical, just ask science, because science actually is telling us this. And science has to be listened in a way that that really brings that. So that's, I think, that the model of from consensus going to conviction is that's basically a model that we need to really go even further in this context. It's speaking truth to power. Something that Greta is doing, or Al Gore, who was actually, he was an incrementalist leader since his leadership as a climate leader after he lost the elections in the US in the early 2000s. And so you can see now that he's really now more vocal and more direct, more blunt, more candid, because that's exactly what we need at this point. We need just to have candid conversations in order just to really come, just to be realistic, but really realistic and not just come into this kind of denialism of let's basically have some incremental changes and, you know, that are not moving the needle.
Right. And do you feel that is a somewhat rising consensus here at New York Climate Week, that we need to be more radical and that our current approaches aren't going far enough? Or, yeah, how would you characterize some of the mood that you've experienced so far here at New York Climate Week?
Well, I mean, the Climate Week has been always, but lately, this is basically with a lot going on, nothing happens. So if you see, for instance, as we speak, today is the Climate Week, and is the Climate Ambition Summit. And there's not actually anything new actually happening. But what it is new in reality is if you see the debates and how many presidents from a head of a state, a head of government from Latin America, from Africa, are speaking up about the need of a deep financial reform. Countries that are stuck on a huge debt crisis because of COVID-19, but also because of natural disasters that actually are impacting heavily in their economies. These countries are just saying this financial system, this architecture is not working any longer, and we need just to reform that. So the what we have seen from the Paris summit, which took place last June, you will see a series of regional blocs and economic blocs actually meeting in Africa and Latin America, calling about having a proper tax convention, so therefore there's no tax havens that take away the money that we need for climate and biodiversity action, a better redistribution of the funds, a reforms of the structural debt reformed, so increasing of money that needs just to go to development. So there are also the tackle of subsidies, both on the ones that actually are damaging the climate and biodiversity. So what we are seeing is that somehow even COVID, and it's one in a moment in COVID that people thought, okay, this is the moment in which we're going to be more equal. We're going to just think about how the world will actually go in a better direction. That debate somehow was lost and was seen. It was basically companies and governments negotiating trillions of dollars in making this world more unequal and less able to actually tackle the climate crisis. However, what we're seeing now is kind of a slow reflect where countries are realizing that this financial architecture needs to change in order just to make an economy that works for the people and the planet. And what we're seeing is a little bit of that in France. Many truths has been told from African governments and Latin American governments, and we are seeing this again in the General Assembly. So I really feel that although there is nothing specific that happens, we are seeing a new consensus that is basically this economy is not working. We need just to fix it We need us to sing this differently. And that's why ideas that 10 years ago were unimaginable now are on the table. And I think that is an interesting development that we are seeing, especially in this UN General Assembly.
It really is the epitome of what we're exploring in this interview series, is how do we re-examine the underpinnings of the architecture of our economy and our financial system. And I think so many of us are coming to that conclusion from so many different walks of life and so many contexts and directions, including ecologically, technically, financially, socially. It's like the economy as we know it is not compatible with life on the planet. Like, that's just what's proving out. I'm curious if we can talk a bit more about some of the financial reforms or some of the campaigns that you think are most important to really shift the dial for how our financial system or our economy is working. You mentioned subsidies and taxes and tax havens. And can we go into a bit more of, you know, what are some of those key initiatives that are most effective in your mind or most promising?
So I think that what we're seeing now in motion in the conversations is the question of debt restructuring, for instance, you know, debt reformed. Mm-hmm. So we see the Bridgetown Initiative led by the Barbados Prime Minister, Mia Motley, and many other small nations actually bringing that idea. And you already see some debt swaps happening, for instance, in Belize, mm-hmm. Ecuador. Mm-hmm. So you are seeing some models and other models that actually are just coming very soon. And so there are already, and of course, they're bilaterals because that's basically how the structure of the financial system works.
Right.
So we don't have an international convention on those.
And if I, sorry to interrupt you, but if I understand correctly, so a debt swap, what some are calling debt swaps for nature, mm-hmm. would be, for example, let's say country A owes country B $50 mm-hmm. million. Dollars. Mm-hmm. So country A is in debt. That debt is forgiven in exchange for some sort of commitment towards conservation or preservation mm-hmm. of a natural ecosystem, a mm-hmm. body of nature, something that where the recognition is that these lands, these areas, whether they're marine protected areas, whether they're forests, rainforests, et cetera, they provide a vital service to the commons, to all of life mm-hmm. on Earth. And so those arrangements are effectively trying to, I guess, kill two birds with one stone. You know, one is to redistribute and equalize the debt arrangements, and another is to preserve land. Do I have that roughly correct? And would you add mm-hmm. anything to kind of, 101, like helping people high level understand mm-hmm. what these debt swaps really are?
Yeah, I think the one thing that also that's a technical way to put it. I would also go into a more philosophical way, which is also countries has an ecological debt. Mm. So what we're here looking is basically a clearing of debts. Mm-hmm. So countries has some financial debts, or the country has environmental debts. If mm-hmm. we talk about, for instance, the footprint of some countries. So what basically, but this financial debtors usually also has an ecological surplus that we can also call it the ecological creditors, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So what we're saying here is that we need just to have a win-win situation where the ecological debtors swap that financial debt and clearing their ecological debt by helping the ecological creditors, but the financial debtors,
right.
To fulfill also the commitments of the ecological debtors.
Right.
So, for instance, France, which has a huge footprint in a variety of areas, they want just to invest, for instance, in DRC, in the Democratic Republic of Congo. So the Republic of Congo is an ecological creditor. Mm-hmm. But they don't have the financial means to keep, for instance, the Virunga Park, or mm-hmm. you know, let's put in an example, right? So mm-hmm. and so what we're looking is that instead of the Democratic Republic of Congo paying a certain amount of money to France, they said we're gonna use that money for these purposes, and therefore France is able just to fulfill some of these commitments, and as well, the Democratic Republic of Congo. So that's one of the models. But there are many other models of the swap for nature. Mm-hmm. The ones that we advocate is one that is more oriented to a debt justice, which means that it's not only about the financial debt, but also the historical debt that countries in the global north has with the countries in the global south. Mm-hmm. And so how are you going just to also create through, for instance, a bond, how you also put capital in a way that the developing nations can also fulfill their commitments in order just to transform the economies and economies that actually works for the environment, works for the people, mm-hmm. meaning sustainable development, meaning local development, training, how we're bringing people away, workers away from coal mining to renewable energy and to bioeconomy mm-hmm. and other elements. So it is for us, it's a question of justice. So it has also to do a lot with the fact that many countries in Europe, in the developed world, they also has a lot of demands for raw materials, for consumption. So how are you going just to also address that? And as well, the transition minerals, mm-hmm. you know, when we talk about electric cars, mm-hmm. batteries. Mm-hmm. So how are you going just to also reconcile those elements? So what we're looking is that debt swap for nature or climate is just one start from a much bigger economical reforms that countries need to have mm-hmm. in order just to meet the commitment that we have, in order just to really radically reduce the footprint, both on biodiversity and in emissions mm-hmm. That impact climate, and in that way stabilize our planet, which is basically key for our economies. So mm-hmm. Right now, most of the countries that actually are at risk of default were countries heavily impacted by climate change. Pakistan mm-hmm. on the floods, mm-hmm. Egypt with drought, Argentina as well with drought, and so on. So mm-hmm. what we're seeing here is a crisis that are basically deeply interrelated. And what we're seeing in the UN General Assembly is more and more presidents talking about how these crises are interrelated and how important it is to both tackle the climate crisis and as well the debt crisis. And that's why it requires a different approach. And that's why, for instance, the International Monetary Fund, last year, for the first time, they put a paper about a debt swap for climate for middle-income countries. Because, mm-hmm. of course, for small countries, it's easier just to have those debt because of the scale. But when we talk about middle-income countries, talking about Brazil, India, South Africa, Argentina, I mean, we're talking about countries that has another extension of territories, another level of environmental impact, mm-hmm. and another level of money involved in these type of transactions. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that the International Monetary Fund is already thinking about how these models can actually work for countries that are G20 level countries is also an indication that there is a lot of eagerness to explore different ways of doing debt restructuring, also, for instance, doing subnational debt restructuring, where you see now a rise of leadership of local governments that they want to actually be part, they want just to be part of the big solution. Mm-hmm. And you also see a lot of subnational sovereign debt that is also now in this process of doing this type of swap with multilateral banks or with governments, with the IMF, or, you know, with the Club of Paris and many other institutions. So mm-hmm. there's a lot of creativity happening, and I think that's a good sign that at least that movement is happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's such a justice issue because you know, there's no denying that the emissions and the extractive activities and the footprint of the global north, to generalize, has been far greater than the global south. And there's no denying that the effects of climate change are much greater and happening in worse way in the global south than the global north. And so, you know, you put two and two together and it's like, well, obviously something needs to be done here. And I'm excited to hear that there's more momentum in this space. And it sounds like you have hope that there's going to be more multilateral agreements and greater activity in this space. I'm curious if you can bring in also the context around indigenous peoples. And, you know, I was particularly struck and wanted to ask you about the agreement that came out of Montreal, because it it did feel like a threshold moment in terms of international recognition. Over 190 countries signed the Kunming Montreal Agreement, the Global Biodiversity Framework. And I wanted to just read for folks, you know, just a couple quick things from the agreement, if I may. It starts out in Section C, considerations for the implementation of the Kunming Montreal Global Biodiversity Framework, and says, contribution and rights of indigenous peoples and local communities. The framework acknowledges the important roles and contributions of indigenous peoples and local communities as custodians of biodiversity and as partners in its conservation, restoration, and sustainable use. The framework's implementation must ensure that the rights, knowledge, including traditional knowledge associated with biodiversity, innovations, worldviews, values, and practices of indigenous peoples and local communities are respected and documented and preserved with their free, prior, and informed consent, including through their full and effective participation in decision-making in accordance with relevant national legislation, international instruments, including the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples and human rights law. In this regard, nothing in this framework may be construed as diminishing or extinguishing the rights that Indigenous peoples currently have or may acquire in the future. And it goes on to actually also spell out different value systems, so including the rights in nature, the rights of nature and rights of Mother Earth. Mm-hmm. Now, I know you've been working on this. It must be a proud moment for you to have seen it after so many years. Yeah. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts and reflections?
I mean, I don't know, I got a bit emotional because just remember how hard it was to get every word of that. It just took 3 years to get into that language. Mm-hmm. And actually it has a history, if you allow me.
Please.
So before the Paris Agreement, we've been working with indigenous organizations to really put that in there. The last night, the government of China and John Kerry basically said, we cannot have this human rights language in the Paris Agreement, and was killed. Mm-hmm. And so in that moment, I remember I just went back and a lot of indigenous organizations were there. It was a horrible moment. It was just like a moment of a lot of frustration and anger. And yet, indigenous organizations, indigenous people says, we're going to stay behind the Paris Agreement. We're going to fight this somewhere. And I got to say that in that moment, many NGOs, many conservation NGOs, they throw indigenous peoples under the bus because they were ready to compromise, because it was important just to that's why basically I'm very critical about the consensus, because sometimes when we talk about constructive ambiguity, it basically sometimes means that we're not going to be clear about exactly what we want just to achieve, because we have this very vague general language that could be interpreted in so many ways. So that's why, you know, when you read that, I remember that you see the level of detail and specificity on what really means indigenous rights. So when we've been discussing the language, one of the things that we felt that day, I remember one indigenous leader who is not any longer with us because he died with COVID, but like many other indigenous peoples, And he said, okay, so, you know, tonight we mourn, tomorrow we organize. And that's basically, we started in 2016, just building this moment for the biodiversity. From then, COVID came in 2020, and that pushed the discussion 2 years later, which actually was very advantage to us just to try just to keep convincing governments about how important is the role of indigenous peoples and really address issues in which you see racism. Like, you know, indigenous peoples knows better than us. I mean, how that works. And one thing that happens in 2019 is that the IPBES, the International Platform for Biological and Ecosystem Services, the kind of the IPCC for biodiversity, they recognize the value of indigenous peoples. And that is statistically science. So it was the first time that the Western science have recognized fully, unreservedly, that the role of indigenous peoples are more effective and they need just to basically be recognized. Mm-hmm. So that was basically a cultural shift for many negotiators. And then we fought a lot because one of the targets, for instance, the 30% target, the first iteration of the 30% target, they talk about protected areas without any mention of indigenous people's rights, without any mention of the free prior informed consent. And in fact, they say so that within the 30%, it needs to be a 10% of strict protected areas, which resonates in a very negative way because indigenous people has suffered the colonial mindset of many conservation organizations that has basically evicted and excluded indigenous peoples from their lands without understanding that indigenous cultures actually are in a very active dialogue with nature. And so it was a fight just to recognize just the right to be, and also to understand that there are many other ways in which indigenous peoples actually are contributing already, even despite you know, the economic practices and so on. And the other thing that we fought very strongly is that the number of the 30% target by 2030 is basically a very low bar, because if you recognize the lands of indigenous peoples, all the lands, at least in the most conservative numbers, we already, the world will have achieved the 32% of lands being protected in different ways, even if it's not recognized. Mm-hmm. So what we are saying is, and still we welcome that target, although we believe, also because science is telling us that we need to protect at least 50% of the lands. Mm-hmm. But still it was a strong recognition of what is the role of indigenous peoples. And so now basically the new fight is how are we going just to get direct funding for indigenous peoples? Because at this point, only indigenous people only receive 1% of the total funding. And so in the Montreal Kunming Agreement, we also have there is another target, which is the target that defines how much money needs just to be put on the table and what will be the fund. The fund has been already defined and is already started in Vancouver a few weeks ago. And so we fought there to have a target of the 20% of those funding needs to go to indigenous peoples without middlemen, without NGOs, without governments managing, but really going to indigenous organizations, to indigenous groups. And now basically we're fighting for that, for the fact that, yes, so there is a recognition that indigenous peoples have a better role, and actually they're managing better the fires. Their forests are less susceptible to the forest fire that we are having in the world, are more healthy. Mm-hmm. And in fact, those areas are financially and economically cheaper to protect, because indigenous people they know that knowledge. So they have that knowledge. And one of the things that we are now really pushing is that governments will put their mouths and the money in the same place, and that's the next fight. But for and us,
is that the $200 billion fund? Is that the target? Do I have that number correct?
So you have the $200 billion mm-hmm. per year. So we needed just to basically have and the Global Environmental Facility, which will be now having the fund for biodiversity, mm-hmm. they needed to have a minimum of $200 million U.S. dollars. Mm-hmm. And in Vancouver, what happens is that Canada has announced $200 million Canadian dollars, and the United Kingdom announced 111 million British pounds, which in total is around 160 million dollars. But in order just to make the fund operational, you need $200 million U.S. dollars.
200 million, not billion.
No, that's basically to be operational.
Just to be operational, yeah.
And from there, you need just to go into $200 billion.
Right.
However, science and even even you know a wide range of economies are indicating that this $200 billion per year is not enough.
No,
so that we need just $1 trillion.
Protecting life on Earth in a $100 trillion global economy, $200 billion is probably not going to do it.
Yeah, exactly. And the thing is, what we're looking is to basically have $1 trillion, which will be basically the 6% of the GDP, mm-hmm. the world GDP. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about protecting 50% of, I mean, the basis of the half of the world economy.
Right.
So the money is there, it's in the wrong hands. Mm-hmm. And I think that one of the things that we feel that it will be a transformational opportunity for the world mm-hmm. is just to invest in indigenous peoples. Mm-hmm. In a moment where, you know, history is reckoning about what is our deep origins, you know, all of our countries were made, our mother nations, our mother state has been made out of dispossessing indigenous nations. So when I came from in Argentina is a country that was made out of the colonies dispossess different indigenous communities. But if we just go to the original map mm-hmm. of what the indigenous communities were, it's quite different than this one. So how you recognize our past? Because I think what in the end, when we talk about restoration, we need just to also be mindful about restitution and reparation. And I think we are in that path, very slow. But I think in order just to meet that level of restoration of our planet, mm-hmm. It has just to also has that element of justice and go back to that spirit of repair and restitute in order just to make an economy that works for all of us.
Yeah, and I would add even just humility, you know, like if there's ever a moment to just take a breath and see that, oh, there are cultures and communities who are stewarding most of the remaining life and biodiversity on this planet. Why don't we learn from what they're doing? Why don't we hand over some of these financial or other types of value resources and to share and redistribute in this moment that we're in, and yeah, just to have some humility. It seems like we're making progress, and it also seems like we're not doing nearly enough fast enough. I'm just curious, like, how do you feel? Like, it must be all of the emotions. It's probably an unfair question, but, mm-hmm. you know, how are we doing overall? And do you have hope for, you know, this coming decade or where are you at?
You know, I was once in the Amazon with the Yanomami community is just facing a huge and a deep humanitarian crisis with, you know, with kids having, you know, problems just to get access to food, which is crazy that, you know, in the Amazon, kids are basically having this malnutrition. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. and there was this this lady, this indigenous leader, that she say, I have faith in Brazil. I have faith in the Amazon. That was during the Bolsonaro times. And that time, Avaaz has been working in delivering humanitarian aid with local partners. And in that moment of having, you know, the worst government that has that open and hostile open war against indigenous peoples, where you see forest fires, illegal occupiers, climate crisis, malnutrition. That lady says, I have faith in Brazil, I have faith in the Amazon. So it's just like that moment basically made me realize that hope is not an entitlement, it's not a right, but it's a duty. So because if they haven't given off, if they haven't given up, how on earth I'm going just to give up? So I think, yes, I mean, the prospects are bad. The governments are not doing good enough. Companies are not helping either. The media are not helping either. And some actors of civil society as well are failing in that level of ambition. But on the other hand, we are moving. And yes, when we talk about consensus, you know, sometimes we will never be happy that that in that consensus is not everything that we wanted. But as long as we're convinced that in that consensus is what we need, that basically is what gives me hope. And the fact that the international community, even for instance, on the Kunming-Montreal Agreement is not ambitious enough, still is a good path to move forward. And it's basically this opportunity is just to transform. So, you know, coming back when I was a teenager, people said, you know, but the Biodiversity Convention is not legally binding. You know, when I was very young and the Convention on Biodiversity just was open, I used that convention to tell the judge, the local judge, that Argentina have committed to protect biodiversity. And we won that case because of that. Even though that convention is not actually made for those purposes, everything that you put in international law, even if it's not a legally binding quote, still can be used in legal cases, still can be used creatively. And so sometimes I question why I'm just basically going to all those international conventions, because when the international consensus is set, that is one tool that we can fight back locally. Because in the end, the truth of the matter is this fight is local. It's not international. It's not here. So the climate crisis is not going to be sorted out in New York in the climate week. It's sorted out in the peripheries with the poor, with the people that suffer, the people that are in the front lines. And this is just basically one of the elements that you have the duty to give to these people so they can stand in the middle of the fires and say, I have faith, I have hope, because the hope is not just this type of positive feeling. It is just the determination that we can actually move forward and that basically there is a path forward. And we build that path forward. We're not expecting just out of the blue that is coming magically. We fight every day and we sweat every day just to make that hope. As it was, for instance, that what you read is in fact the hope that we built the day after of that deletion, of that deletion of the paragraph, that epic loss that we had in Paris. We built that hope towards Montreal and we won, because we will never win if we don't lose first. And yes, we are losing now terribly, but we are building the basis to keep that hope up.
Yeah, so beautifully said, Oscar. Thank you. And I love this frame that hope is our duty. And yes, I see it every day that 30 by 30 gives us a way in our local communities, on every farm and every forest. And, you know, where is that 30% of wildlands and protection? And now let's do half. You know, we have to protect half. And it just that hope that keeps us going and gives us that determination. I so appreciate your work. Are there any final messages or any words you'd like to share?
I think is that we have the obligation to to shift our thinking between survival to thrive. Mm. We do have the right to thrive, not to survive. And that all of us, we can thrive. And I think sometimes we just get lost in the climate nihilism, you know, like, oh my God, this summit is just a waste of time. Nothing happens here, etc. Let's basically fight for those specific languages that then we can use in another fight, and then in another fight, and then in another fight. So this is not Hollywood. We are not just in half an hour we're gonna win the war. No, that never happens. And indigenous peoples around the world has been fighting for decades to have the recognition, and still they're not de facto recognizing even that. Already there's a lot of progress. So it's a construction, you know, and I want to just, when I get retired, just to be proud that at least I gave the movement something to work with, to keep working, because it's going to be, I mean, the next couple of decades are going just to be tough. And so we need just to build a resilience among ourselves, and at the same time also to have the peace of mind that, yes, we do what we can, we need to do more, and at the same time also avoid that anxiety that we're having. And I have a lot of anxiety about you know, how the next generations would live, but at the same time also important just that although there is that anxiety just to move fast, there is also the need just to move together. And if it means that we need just to move slower, but moving together, then it will be better that way. So therefore, we can work even in these most apocalyptic moments. But I think there is this fine line about how to listen to science and not get depressed, but just to really get determined. And yet, you know, go back at least to that image of this indigenous woman that couldn't actually has enough food for their kids, and stand with hope and say that even in the middle of the fires, in the middle of a political enemy, standing with hope, because that's all what we have, that's all what we got, and we need to stand with that, and remembering that the people in the front lines are counting on us to really fight to death, to every language in the international community, in the IMF, in the United Nations, and everywhere, because we do have the privilege to be in these cities, and that's basically what we got. So we need just to build that resilience, and I feel that the movement needs just to move away from that kind of nihilism, not be positive, just for the sake of being positive, but to really see what is in the details of the text, read more of the text, not just basically organizing this type of events, but really moving into a space where, technically speaking, we are solid and we can fight in the courts, in the international negotiations, in the governments. That's what I feel that we are called for, just to go with the power of knowledge, with truth-telling advocacy, and just expose the governments. And then if the governments are not moving, just calling the people just to move these governments out and put other new ones who can actually do what needs to happen. And I'm very positive that that is happening. And I'm very hopeful that the movement also will get together more strongly and move forward together.
Mm. Oscar Soria, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Oscar. I was really touched by his humanity and the heart that he brings into this work. To learn more about Avaaz, go to avaaz.org. There's a link in the show notes. You can find all of our conversations from New York Climate Week at maearth.com, as well as our YouTube channel. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you on the next one.